Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
To pay the cost, and so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yeah, we did, baby. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dawn Williams. We're back again for another Soultopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Got a little interference there. This is Harvey Wasserman following the incomparable Pete Seeger and the wonderful David Burns with Dawn Williams. We're going to talk today about pot. We've done it before. We're going to do it again. But we are on the brink of some major changes with marijuana, and we've got two of the best experts in the country to talk about it. David and Eric, you're both with us?
Yes, sir. How are you today?
Good. How are you? David, is that you?
It is.
And Eric, you're with us? Eric Storming,
you there? Yeah.
All right, great, great. Okay, you're two of the best. Eric, you've been on the show before from the Drug Policy Institute. It's really great to have you on. You are incredibly knowledgeable and one of the real leaders in the movement to end this insane, ridiculous, stupid, wasteful, and otherwise unconscionable prohibition on marijuana. David, you've not been on the show before. Can you, David, do a favor and introduce yourself? Tell us how you'd like us to think of you as we proceed through this hour on cannabis.
Sure, thank you. Eric, hi, nice to meet you as well, by the way. It's a pleasure to be here today. And really, my name is David Dinnenberg, and I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Kind Financial. And Kind Financial, what we've really turned into lately is we're the largest, most dominant technology compliance company in the industry.
Well, okay, first of all, I'm going to come back to you in a second. Eric, you're on the phone. Tell us, introduce yourself, Eric Sterling, and tell us who you are and what you do, and then I'm going to start with David. He's already got my interest here. Eric, tell us who you are. Eric Sterling?
Harvey and listeners, I'm Eric Sterling, and at the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, I've been executive director since 1989. We set it up as a anti-drug prohibition organization after I had worked for the U.S. Congress for 9 years at the House Judiciary Committee, working on money laundering, gun control, organized crime, pornography, and drug laws. And we serve primarily to help consult with people in trying to end the war on drugs, set up organizations. So I helped start a group called Families Against Mandatory Minimums in 1990. I helped start the Marijuana Policy Project in 1994, 1995, and other groups as well. Currently, I'm on the board of directors of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And in the state of Maryland, our governor appointed me to the State Medical Cannabis Commission, so I'm one of the few medical cannabis commissioners in the United States.
You are a stalwart of the movement, Eric. It's really been a pleasure to know you and to work with you, and an honor over the years in this ridiculous drug war. I mistakenly said the Drug Policy Institute. I meant the Marijuana Policy Institute. But all right, so let's proceed. It appears, and one of the reasons for so is it appears that California, the people of California have showed up with more than enough signatures to get legalization on the ballot in the fall, full legalization. And the Ohio legislature, one of the most backward, thoroughly lobotomized legislatures in the country, appears now to be on the brink of some kind of legalization of medical marijuana. So we're going to get to that. But, David, I'm intrigued by your self-introduction. Give us a little more on your technological aspects and exactly and your financial aspects. It sounds like you came to the pot issue a little bit through the back door. Is that right?
It is. It is. I currently live in Los Angeles. I moved here just about 3 years ago to actually start this company. When I lived back east in Philadelphia, I was in the real estate business for over 25 years. I was a real estate developer. I was a broker, a retail specialist. I did all different kinds of things. So I do come from a structured, background, but not in cannabis and really not in financial services. But I saw a program in 2012 and it talked about the emergence of, at that point, it was strictly medicinal marijuana and the 15 or 16 states at that point that were involved in it. And as I'm watching the program, you know, if you would have coughed, you would have missed the 15 seconds where they're talking about the fact that it's all cash, there's no banking, there's no structure to the industry. And really, you know, living back east, I wasn't 100% familiar with the emergence of what was taking place out west, so I studied it and learned a lot. And, you know, in full disclosure and honesty, you know, I got pretty much wiped out during the real estate crash in 2008.
And welcome to the club.
Yeah, right? And really, okay. I was trying to, you know, I stayed with my company. I was a partner in my company. I stayed with it. But, you know, I was looking for something new to do and to really just, you know, do something. And I saw this as a huge opportunity. Quite frankly, it started out as a research project for me. And then after I did the research, I did figure out, you know, I couldn't understand why, you know, even though it's illegal at the federal level, they were allowing these states to do the things they were doing, but yet the federal government wasn't really, you know, fully allowing it to flourish because they were, you know, the banking problem, which is primarily in, I'd like to hear Eric's opinion on that, has been stuck in neutral, if not reverse, for a very long time. So I set out to try and help and solve this problem. And, you know, so where I am today, what we do today, you know, I'm really proud of what we do, and I'm even more proud of the people that I have on our team and that are involved in this company, which is we're one of the only companies, you know, I think we're the only company, but I'll hedge it and say we're the only company in the legal cannabis industry that truly has ex-federal regulators, ex-law enforcement coming together to create solutions with compliance as the backbone. And we have different tranches of that, different products. We have a seed-to-sale track and trace software that is the core of any compliant program. As the new states are coming on board, they are all requiring the businesses, whether it's dispensary or grow or production facility, to have a seed-to-sale inventory tracking program. So,
I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. First, I have to ask you a critical question.
Yes.
When you were wiped out and in 2008 and you saw this show on the emerging marijuana industry, were you a pot smoker?
The short answer is yes. I had tried marijuana prior to that. My interest had nothing to do with the actual smoking of the product. I'm just being honest with you. My interest really came from the fact that I didn't fully comprehend or understand how you could have a quote-unquote state legal business yet not having federal banking support. So that's where my interest came from. It also stemmed from the fact that, you know, I truly believe that marijuana is completely less harmful than a lot of other things that are legal in this country, that are controlled by this country, and that as it was emerging to becoming a legitimate business, I really felt like it needed the proper opportunity to develop into a proper industry. And the only way it would develop into a proper industry is to support it on the financial sector and give it a backbone and give it structure. So that's truly where the interest came from. Have I ever used marijuana? The short answer is yes.
Well, I wouldn't let you on the program if you hadn't. So, so obviously, unlike me and Eric, who come to it genetically with an affinity for pot, you came from the business angle, and it's very interesting to me. I'm sure it is Eric too, because you know I've been fighting nuclear power for 45 years, and the parallel track on that is the rise of renewable energy. And we all knew, especially from You know, when those of us who marched against the Vietnam War were fully aware of the fact that the war was going to stop once the corporations realized that it was no longer good for the economy and certainly not profitable for them. Now, there is always an entrenched interest, and always is an entrenched interest, in fighting war. You do have a military-industrial complex, as Dwight Eisenhower described it. But at some point during the Vietnam conflict, the rest of the corporations thought, hey, this is worse for our business than it is good for you, and we're going to have to shut this down. Now, in renewable energy, you know, all of us knew that as soon as the curve on the economics of renewables outstripped the curve of the income and the profitability of nuclear, that nuclear was going to start to go down, and that's obviously been happening for a while. Now, the pot industry, people have been saying for 50 years that pot would be a tremendous boon, legal pot would be a tremendous boon to the economy. Now, you raised a really interesting issue, which I'm sure has Eric's interest as well, which is how do you legally, financially run a business that is legal on the state level and illegal on the federal level? It's really bizarre. So clearly that's what you're doing. Is that right?
Well, the short answer is very carefully. But the true answer is the federal government, you know, has the top cop in our country, which is, you know, the Department of Justice, through the Attorney General's office, through Assistant Attorney General Cole, have clearly sent out to America and to law enforcement, you know, the parameters of how people in this country can conduct business in this gray space. So, you know, I wake up every day feeling very comfortable in how we conduct our business, who we do business with, and what business we do. We do not touch the product at all. We support the industry through infrastructure and technology. That's truly what we do. You know, at the end of the day, if you run your business legitimately, if you run your business transparently, if you're abiding by your state law and doing all the necessary things that you're supposed to be doing, by the directive of the Cole memo that came out in the fall of 2013, the federal government's supposed to leave you alone. So the problems that we all read about and see in the industry, you know, there's bad apples in any industry. I mean, you could read about money laundering for people selling widgets. I mean, if you want to break the law, you can break the law. Let's be honest with each other, right?
Well, so tell us exactly what you do, and I want to let Eric weigh in. Are you running banks and financial services for people in the hot businesses? Is that what you're doing?
Here's 100% of what we do. So we're a technology-based company. So we have, as I was saying a little bit earlier, we have a technology that follows the plant from the day it's planted to the day that it's sold. Okay, that's one of our products. We have a cash management division that utilizes kiosks to control and verify not only cash, making sure it's, you know, not counterfeit, but it also verifies the patient, verifies their age, makes sure that the patient cannot cross shop between different dispensaries, that they're not overbuying, you know, those types of things. And then we're partners in another company that's called Link to Banking. And Link to Banking is a fascinating company. Link to Banking is chaired by an ex-federal regulator from FinCEN, which is a division of Treasury that oversees financial crimes. The president of that company is a ex-banker. He is still a certified anti-money laundering specialist, as well as he's a data specialist. So Link to Banking goes into a bank, and what they do is they evaluate the AML BSA written platform that every bank in the country has.
You guys know what that is. What is AML?
Oh, I'm sorry. Anti-Money Laundering Bank Secrecy Act.
When was that passed?
Oh, God. Those laws have been in the 80s,
I think. The Bank Secrecy Act is originally from 1970. The money laundering provisions were written in 1986.
Thank you, Eric. So our guys go in, they evaluate the Bank Secrecy Act, anti-money laundering written program. They make any additional suggestions if it needs to be improved, in their opinion. And then what we do, or what they do, I should say, is they actually help the bank in making their cannabis compliance program. And then Rob does the president of the company does a data validation for the company, for the bank. And then what we do is downstream, right, meaning that in the bank's customers, we put in our infrastructure, which is the seed-to-sale traceability as well as the kiosks. And at the bank level, after we're finished doing the programs, we provide the bank with a piece of software. And this is the fascinating part, guys. The software allows the bank to not only understand their customer, but it helps them understand their customer's customer. And what I'm really talking about is, if you look at the cold memo
out there.
I'm sorry?
The guy who's out there getting stoned.
Well, what it does is, the Cole memo sets forth, and the FinCEN memo that came out in February of 14, they set forth about 8 high priorities that the federal government wants the states to be aware of to make sure the licensees are in compliance with. And what we do is we take that a step further, and we put the banks in the position of over-complying with the Cole and FinCEN documents. So at the end of the day, if a bank is using our infrastructure, they have a bird's eye view into their client, which is the bank, which is either the dispensary or the grow or production facility, as well as they have an idea on their on the customer's customer. So therefore, they're making sure that everyone's in compliance with the doctrines. And at the end of the day, we have bank clients today. They have gone through their state or FDIC inspection, and they received no comments to our program. So we're really proud of what we've done. We've taken a long time. We've been very diligent in making sure it's true and it works and it's proper. And we've had a very good reception from it. So at the end of the day, what we're doing is we're sitting between basically the banking institutions and the cannabis industry.
Eric Sterling, what do you think of all this?
Well, what it's John, right?
No, oh, David. It's David.
But David, it is David. I beg your pardon. I missed the introductions in the haste of the beginning. David, this is really important work that you're doing, because for the cannabis industry in the current conflict between federal and state law, the ability to work with banks has been the biggest headache. Not having access to banks' merchant services, credit cards, deposits, checking, has been a tremendous headache for all the people who are in both the medical cannabis businesses around the country and then in the legal cannabis businesses in states like Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska. So this is really important. The doctrines, the memoranda that David has talked about, are not actual changes in the law.
In the law,
but are only sort of guidance documents. The banks have been very cautious, fearful about getting involved in the black and white of the law is still money laundering and still means that they're facing very, very high criminal penalties and potentially the loss of their entire business. And so developing a way to assure essentially the general counsel of the bank that they can comply with the federal regulatory requirements is really, really important.
Well, we're talking about a lot of money here too, aren't we? I mean, this is you're in L.A., I think everybody's assuming that the legalization referendum is going to pass in the fall. How much money are we? Well, you can tell us what either one of you how much money is in the medical marijuana business in California. What do we think it's going to be after pot's legalized?
Harvey, there's a group called ArcView that studies this,
yep.
And their estimate is it's something for this year on the order of $4 billion and maybe $6 billion plus next year.
Well, Eric, I agree with you. We're talking about an industry today that's anywhere between $4 and $6 billion that going towards, you know, by 2020 is going to start touching a $20 billion number.
That's just in California.
No,
that's
States.
Nationwide. That's nationwide.
California
is an interesting market. It is, you know, not to use it's the 100-pound gorilla in, you know, quite frankly, medicinal as well as illicit marijuana. I would say that, you know, no one really knows the true number in the California market because it's not a very robust regulated market right now, which is unfortunate. But California, I would say very confidently, and I'll lowball it, California is already a larger medicinal market than Colorado. California is probably already a $2 billion market by itself today.
How much I don't know if
Eric's going to agree with me or not on that one, but that's how I feel about it.
Well, remember, California in population is something like 8 to 10 times bigger than Colorado. So
right.
It's not a surprise.
Sure.
You know, it's a huge, huge state. You know, it's a tenth of the size of the United States. So it's huge.
I think what I've heard in the past is I think the state of California is the sixth largest economy in the world.
Yes, that's right. It's also it would probably be around the it would rank as a separate country. It would be in the top 50. I mean,
yeah.
Between around 35 million people live in California.
So what
is the name of your company, David?
It's called Kind Financial.
Kind, T-I-M-E?
K-I-N-D, K.
Oh, Kind, K-I-N-D, okay.
Yeah.
As opposed to Duckine from Hawaii. So you wouldn't be the only organization doing what you're doing. Essentially, let me see if I can paraphrase what you're doing. Maybe Eric can give a little more sophisticated view, but this is an important transition. Obviously, in the ending of cannabis prohibition here, what you do is you are a consulting agency to show people, both banks and cannabis business people, how to deal with cash through the banking system and not get busted by the feds. Is that a fair assessment of what you do?
The way I would like to frame it is more of we are the ultimate compliance company in the cannabis industry, and we do compliance through, track and trace. We do compliance through cash management, and we have a partner company that does compliance for banks. So at the end of the day, we are the back. We're trying to be, and I believe that we are. We're going to be the compliance backbone for the cannabis industry, because what I fundamentally believe is this: no one knows the future of legalization in this country. I mean, there are people, and Eric, I guarantee you, you're one of them, that have a very good idea of what the DEA might do in June or July and what you predict the future of legalization to look like. But someone like me, I don't claim to ever know the future. If I knew the future, we probably wouldn't be talking to each other. But here's what I feel very confident in saying. No matter what happens to marijuana, whether it's rescheduled, descheduled, legalized, whatever it happens to it, it is still going to be a very heavy regulated industry. More than alcohol, more than cigarettes. So at the end of the day, because I can't predict the future, what I've chosen to do is create a compliance company, because compliance in this industry, I fundamentally believe, is going nowhere. And then to answer your other question, Harvey, there are other companies in this industry. There are other seed-to-sale companies. There are other banking consulting companies. There are other cash management companies. But we are the only company that had the foresight to put everything under a brand and to keep everything together and to bring people together that can make the best products. Because I also fundamentally believe that as this industry changes and evolves, your products have to change and evolve. And the only way you can bring quality products to the market is to have quality people. And we have the best talented people in the industry.
All right, so let's get into the nitty-gritty here. Eric, you are the man. Wait a minute, I have to rephrase that. You're not the man. You're the guy who's been fighting the man for all these decades. Where are we at now with ending cannabis prohibition in the United States? What do we see happening this year, and what's going to be happening in the near term?
We're in the middle of a big fight, and it's not a fight that is by any stretch over. the opponents to legalization are organizing as fast as they can. They're organizing anti-tobacco activists. They are organizing people in the anti-drug abuse community. They're arguing that if we go down the road to legalization that we're on, we're going to end up with a gigantic, powerful industry like the tobacco industry or the alcohol industry that will operate with complete indifference to public health and addiction and juvenile use, that they'll have the power to buy members of state legislatures and powerful law firms and be able to become another blight on the society. This is the argument that they're making. And there are many people who are still alarmed about marijuana. They are doing whatever they can to highlight the questions that exist around the psychological effects of heavy use of very strong marijuana by very young people, its role in mental illness, any other kinds of potential harmful effects. They're working as hard as they can with the law enforcement agencies that stand to lose a great deal of salary and bonuses and benefits if marijuana is legalized. So this is not an effort that is somehow over because the polls show that the public wants this. The American public overwhelmingly wants various kinds of controls on firearms. But those of us who follow this issue know that the National Rifle Association has an enormous amount of political power, that it's disproportionate to the number of people who take its positions. So the first thing to sort of keep in mind is that we're in the middle of this struggle. The other side of it is that we have momentum with us. Groups like the Marijuana Policy Project, NORMAL, and the Drug Policy Alliance, and many, many local groups are working very hard on a state-by-state basis. And so we're going to have a vote in California. We're going to have a vote in Maine. We're going to have a vote in Massachusetts. It's Florida. Quite possible that the Vermont legislature will pass this. Arizona and Nevada are also potentially in play. So depending on what happens, we could see, you know, several states, up to a half a dozen states in November, passing laws that would legalize adult recreational use of marijuana. That creates a tremendously greater political challenge to begin to rationalize state and federal law. But we are facing, at least with the current Congress, still a lot of ideological opposition. But even the current Congress is very funny. The current Congress has voted twice to ban the DEA from enforcing federal law against medical marijuana organizations in medical marijuana states. And they even passed a law that allowed the profits in adult recreational marijuana to be handled in a certain financial way. I'm having a brain fart. I apologize. I'm forgetting the exact provision.
That's the FinCEN memo, I believe you're talking about, Eric.
Well, no, I'm not talking about the memo. I'm talking about act of Congress.
They defunded the DOJ from enforcing the law.
Yes,
from going
that's,
after,
that's correct. That's in the appropriations bills. There's a different provision I'm thinking of, and I'm apologize. I can't remember it right now.
Okay.
So the situation is in flux, and it is important, you know, that people who think that these laws need to be changed, should be changed, stay active and support, both through their political activity and through their donations, groups like the Marijuana Policy Project and others, because this is going to be a very big fight. The opposition organizations are funded by drug companies. They are funded by the liquor companies. They recognize that marijuana is a competitor for them in both the pharmaceutical marketplace and in the intoxication marketplace. And
Eric, I don't mean to ask questions and harm.
No, please do. Go ahead.
Do you have an opinion or a guess on what happens with the DEA and what they're going to do, whether they reschedule, deschedule, or do nothing?
I don't have an opinion, and the reason is that I don't have any good information. I can tell you what I think some of the considerations are, but I don't have a prediction. Their historic inclination will be to do nothing, to continue to rely upon the evidence they think shows that marijuana is dangerous and that marijuana does not have an accepted medical use according to the very, very narrowly constructed criteria that they've used. What we often forget in all of the lawlessness that we see around us, that government agencies try, as a general matter, to comply with the law. And the law, there are very specific provisions that DEA is supposed to look at in deciding whether or not marijuana would be medical. And those are not the ones that you and I might use. They're not the ones that a doctor is going to use in talking with a patient about whether or not they think there's evidence to support using it in the treatment of certain kinds of pain or muscle spasticity or eating disorders or nausea or, just as examples. They're looking at questions of the whether or not marijuana exists as a replicated medicine. They're looking at questions where the marketplace hasn't yet been able to meet the very specific criteria that they're going to look at. And so I can't predict what they're going to do.
Well, there has been, Eric, let me jump in real quick. There seems to be some serious discussion of taking marijuana off Schedule 1 and putting it on the Schedule 2 or 3. And that seems to me to be a pretty big deal in terms of the drug war. Is that correct?
Well, again, yes or no. Remember, cocaine is Schedule 2. Amphetamines are in Schedule 2. These are drugs that are still not used recreationally. Their medical use is very, very narrowly controlled. There's still an enormous amount of crime and abuse associated with those drugs. A problem that I see potentially with marijuana in Schedule 2 is while it removes a very important stigma that's associated with Schedule 1, from a bureaucratic point of view, everybody who's involved in the medical cannabis business would have to become registered with the DEA.
Yep.
And there are lots, it's one thing to register with a state medical cannabis agency. It's another thing to register with the DEA and to have the DEA coming in and inspecting your finances, your physical plant, the backgrounds of all your employees.
And the condition of your facility.
Yes, all of that.
I mean, the standards, I don't think anyone in this industry that's in it today is even thinking about, I'm sure they're thinking about it, but they probably can't afford to have the Schedule 2 standards that they're going to need to have for research and for lab testing and all those things as well.
Well, the most important thing is that if you know, once DEA has regulatory authority and can simply bring a simple lawsuit against you, as you know, saying yep. you are now subject to this law in a different kind of way, in a regulatory way,
changes.
It's potentially a much more crushing kind of control than the current situation, which is being sort of outlaws and in a gray area. So it's one thing. It's easier in some sense. It's easier to operate in a gray area than it is to operate in an area where the law is very clear and it's oppressive.
Right.
And that's I guess my fear about going to Schedule II. I think that marijuana should be taken out of the Controlled Substances Act at all, descheduled the way Senator Bernie Sanders is arguing. I think and leaving it to the states, and that gives you, I think the best opportunity to develop the kinds of models that are going to end up sort of working best, because you're going to experiment with different kinds of models of control.
But a lot of the smart people I've spoken to, Eric, totally agree with you as far as it should be descheduled, and they agree with you. But I guess my question to that would be, and I'm naive to this, so I don't claim to have, you know, anything other than my own thought, which is, you know, how does the federal government go from calling something, you know, no medicinal value, completely illegal, gateway drug, you know, basically Schedule One, and saying, you know what, now it's descheduled. I just think going from Schedule One to a deschedule is a huge leap for a government to do. Am I wrong in that thought process?
Well, it's in a certain sense, yes. I mean, you know, just think about our relationship with Cuba, from being an outlaw pariah nation to now we have an embassy to now we have cruise ships. I mean,
that took 60 years.
Well, yes. I mean, the question is when you're looking your starting point from. I'm simply noting that, very dramatic change can happen very quickly as far as that goes. And, this year will be 20 years since medical marijuana passed in Proposition 215, in California with the Compassionate Use Act. So we've had medical marijuana in California for 20 years.
Hey, guys, listen, I'm going to jump in. Eric and David, we have a caller. Ronald, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from the San Francisco Bay Area, which is a subject that might relate to what you were talking about. But I have a subject that I'm interested in, and you may have a focus on this, is we have nuclear plants across this country. Specifically, I think it's 24 that GE designed alone that have radioactive waste from the plants stored above ground. Now, when we heard these reports from France and Belgium about the terrorists looking at plants to possibly want to take and steal some nuclear material to make a dirty bomb, what's to keep across this country with a wristwatch as being the guide at multiple sites from our above-ground sites being struck by short-range missiles that would actually have a simultaneous attack across how many, I don't know, of these sites? Don't we need to clean up our nuke sites and really protect them? Don't we need to save our blood and wealth on foreign shores to protect ourselves from basically a 2,000-year pollution of us and the globe?
Okay, I'm going to answer that because it's a question near and dear to my heart. But then we're going to return to the subject at hand, if that's all right with you.
Thank you.
I will do many more shows on nukes. You have raised a good point, Ronald, about terrorism, terror attacks on nuclear power plants. I think it's inevitable that one is going to happen, God forbid. It's amazing that we haven't been attacked yet, and that, of course, all these nuclear power plants, there's about 400 or so worldwide, about 99 in the U.S., are vulnerable, and God help us if they are attacked and if we have an earthquake at a place, for example, like Diablo Canyon in California or Indian Point near New York City. So thanks for that. Ronald, they call us on another show when we're dealing with the nuclear issues. Okay, I appreciate that. Let's go back to pot now. That's a segue there, but let me tell you my feeling. I just finished the History of the United States, my third draft. It's a cycle of history, and when I get to the drug war,
You know, the drug war was launched, and I'll want your comments on this, especially you, Eric, because you deal so much on the political side. The drug war really was a very political and has been a very political entity. There are, most recently, a quote has surfaced from John Ehrlichman, who was Richard Nixon, one of Richard Nixon's henchmen, which I do not have the stomach to repeat verbatim, but basically he said that Nixon hated hippies, hated black people, and wanted to get at them somehow, basically came up with the drug war, knew that the drugs were not a public problem number one, which is what he said in 1971, and that the whole drug war really has been aimed at repressing black people and the counterculture. And having gone through Michelle Alexander's book, an astonishing book and really a very important book, The New Jim Crow. Bob Fitrakis and I, my co-conspirator on election protection issues, came up with an estimate of 41 million people having been, well, 41 million arrests. You and I, Eric, discussed this, and you pointed out that a number of people have been arrested more than once. But since 1971, 41 million arrests for drugs in this country, very specifically targeted at blacks, at Hispanics, and at young people. And the political impact of these 41 million arrests, I mean, it would have been cheaper to send everybody arrested to college, frankly, you know, has been devastating, catastrophic. It's certainly moved the country to the right and certainly gutted our communities of color and at least part of the counterculture. I think basically the counterculture has won, but that's a different story. Now, what kind of impact on our country do you think shall we say, de-escalation of the drug war is going to have? And how quickly can we make it happen? Eric, let's start with you on that.
Well, first, I agree with the basic premise that the role that drug prohibition plays in American society is to maintain white privilege. It doesn't keep drugs out of the hands of kids. It doesn't prevent crime. It doesn't prevent death or disease. But what it does do is it creates in and reinforces in the mind of much of the culture that drugs is a black problem. It's an urban problem. And it plays out then not only in the arrests but in the collateral consequences of those arrests. So it means people don't get the kinds of jobs that they could get. They can't go to college because they've got a drug conviction. They can't not eligible for federal financial aid. They are excluded from public housing. They're excluded from specific kinds of licenses and jobs. And so it begins to sound very much like what the rules of segregation in Jim Crow were prior to the civil rights era. I think it's important to recognize that, and then to recognize that changing the marijuana laws to legalize marijuana is, I think, going to do little to redress the consequences. Unless you have amnesty, unless you have situations where convictions are erased, unless we have reparations, because the consequences of how drug enforcement has meant many neighborhoods are subject to crime and disorder, families don't have fathers, communities don't have male role models. These are economic and social consequences that don't simply get fixed because people aren't going to any longer be arrested for marijuana offenses. It's a much deeper kind of change in the way in which the police are managed and trained, and how they're held accountable is going to be critical to sort of fixing the criminal justice piece of this. But even if there is equal justice, the historic consequences need to be addressed.
Eric, I agree with what you said, and I'd like to take, you know, a different spin on it a little bit. And, you know, fundamentally, when I talk about this topic, I talk about it from a business standpoint sometimes. And I think one way to look at this is, and I always say, it's addition through subtraction, okay? We spend, out of the $50 billion a year that we spend on the war on the war on drugs in this country, we spend about, I think the number is $21 or $22 billion a year fighting the war on marijuana, first of all. Second of all, we spend a couple billion dollars every year incarcerating the marijuana offenders. That's not... So if we did something, you know, decriminalizing, legalizing, whatever word we want to use here, we're talking about, before you even touch $1 of tax revenue, you're talking about saving the federal government, you know, call it $25 billion a year. That's real money. It pays for something. It probably pays for a few things. But I at the end of the day, I agree with Eric, which is, if something doesn't work, everyone's habit, whether it's a business, our child, our kids, whatever it is, you throw money at something, and you keep throwing money at it. And at some point, you have to say to yourself, you know what? We've been throwing money at something for 20, 30, 40 years, and it's still not working. And it doesn't help anybody. And if anything, it destroys families. And at the end of the day, you know, we need to take care of our own people, and we need to do the right thing in our own country these days. You know, we're very good at taking care of everyone overseas, but we kind of always forget the people that live here. And, you know, I think, you know, the way the feds can look at this and make heads of tails of it, unfortunately, is through the eyes of economics. And I think it's time to truly look at the economics of our criminal justice system. You know, it's obvious to everyone who is targeted by our criminal justice system. And I think Eric already touched upon that, so I'm not going to do that. I agree with him. But I think if you look at it from a fiscal standpoint, I think you get buy-in at some point. And I think you start seeing, you know, you've seen President Obama releasing some nonviolent drug offenders over the last 6 months. And I think he's trying to do something. But I think at the end of the day, he only can do so much. And it's going to have to be, like Eric said earlier, as far as, you know, participating by donations or supporting your politicians or the organizations. And I think that's a big point that we have to do now in correcting the criminal justice system as well.
Well, I think one of the things you have to remember about the economics of the drug war is who benefits. I mean, one that's been spawned, you know, one of the foul offshoots of the drug war has been a for-profit prison system.
Of course.
You know, Eric was listing some of the people who are vested in continuing to keep marijuana illegal, including the drug companies, the recreational alcohol industry, the pharmaceutical businesses, and, of course, the drug dealers themselves. Is now we've created this Frankenstein monster of a for-profit prison system, which is terrifying.
No.
It's
disgusting. It's disgusting, but you know, you have to change, and change is hard, but you have to start. You know, you have to make the decision to start if you actually want to change something. And to touch on something else that you said, what most people don't know is this. In the state of Colorado, the beer industry, they like medicinal marijuana. They like recreational marijuana, and I'll tell you why. The facts will tell you that beer sales are up in the state of Colorado and DUIs are down. And fundamentally, we all know on this phone why that happens, because the person at home is participating in the marijuana industry, and they get the munchies and they stay home and they eventually fall asleep. They don't get in their cars. They don't drive anywhere. And that's a true fact. So I'll tell you that DUIs are down, and I'll tell you that beer sales are up. Now, if you look at beer sales throughout the rest of the country, beer sales are down. So why the beer lobby is against this, I would have no idea. And quite frankly, I don't believe that they are.
What do you think, Eric? How do beer and marijuana sales interface?
Well, in research terms, we don't really have a clear idea. There are conflicting studies. Some suggest that when pot is smoked, people drink more. Others show that there's a substitution effect, that people drink less. So there are different studies, and I don't think the evidence is clear on this particular point.
I bet chip sales go way up.
I'm sorry?
Doritos. I bet Doritos out there watching.
You know, joking aside, you want to look at the data, and in many cases, we don't have good data to sort of show remember that, you know, the effect on the beer market are not driven exclusively by the changing patterns of marijuana users. You know, to what extent are there more marijuana users in Colorado now because marijuana has been legalized for adult use or not? We don't know that there's a dramatic increase in the number of users, and so the increase in beer sales may be completely unrelated to changes in marijuana use patterns in Colorado.
Probably had a lot to do with the Broncos winning the Super Bowl, I would guess.
So I did want to discuss just a couple of things that David said, and whether or not we're going to see savings in criminal justice expenditures is very much an open question. If you look, for example, at the federal prison system, you have, 195,000 people in prison now. It's a $7 billion a year expenditure. But it's 40% overcrowded. Assume that you let out of federal prisons 40,000 prisoners. They're not going to close federal prison facilities down. They're not going to lay off federal prison workers because they're still going to be at 100% capacity. Their food costs may go down, but their health care costs may go down, but their labor costs are going to remain the same. The capital costs are going to remain the same. Figuring out where, if the police are not doing marijuana arrests, they're not going to fire police officers. They may focus on other kinds of activities. And so hypothesizing that there's going to be a significant dollar savings at the end of this makes assumptions about how budgets are decided by legislative bodies I don't think is accurate. When we talk about private prisons, and the private prison industry is on the order of about a $2 billion a year industry, I think the more important thing from a business point of view is that the war on drugs, by giving so many people criminal records, has meant tens of million American men can't earn as much money as they otherwise would, and therefore can't operate in the economy the way they would. So if I'm an investor in Amazon.com, or if I own a furniture company, or if I sell shoes, I'm selling a whole lot less stuff because the American market is hurt because of drug convictions that my customer base endures. And these are competition. So, look, in simple terms, up until through the 1970s, the American auto industry is this strong, dynamic industry. War on drugs gets declared in the 1970s. Millions of people get drug convictions, and we have auto industry in bankruptcy, in the United States, and the auto industry being on life support. Well, if you have a drug felony conviction, you don't have a job with a paycheck that lets you get a car loan. If you're in prison, you don't buy a car. So a prison population was 250,000 people in 1970. It's 2.3 million people now. It's 10 times as many people. Well,
yeah, it's insane.
We're talking about tens of thousands of car sales a month that are not taking place of American-made cars simply because of the war on drugs.
Yeah, and I got to say, we're nearing the end here. This could go on for hours. It's an incredibly important dialogue here in terms of what's going to happen to our country. Eric, can you identify yourself again and give us how people can get a hold of you and look at your materials?
Sure. So I'm Eric Sterling, and I'm the executive director of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. Our website is www.cjpf.org, our initials. And we've got some material that people might find interesting on our website. And I work very closely with Students for Sensible Drug Policy. That's also known as schoolsnotprisons.org. And with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, leap.cc.org. Leap.cc.
Beautiful. And David, give us your particulars real quick before we go on.
Sure. David Dinnenberg, founder and CEO of Kind Financial, and our website is kind.financial. We are a cannabis compliance technology company.
And if you're going into the pot business, you're probably the guy you want to call second or third after you started your
or if you're a state or municipality and you're going to legalize marijuana in your state, yes, you need to talk to us.
All right, so we've spent except for a brief interlude on nuclear power, an hour discussing one of the most important developments in our country today. The end of marijuana prohibition is the end of alcohol prohibition was a huge deal. And, it happened very, very rapidly. It's the only time in U.S. history that an amendment was repealed by another amendment, the 18th, going into the 21st. Marijuana seems to be taking a slightly different route. Obviously, we haven't had an amendment against marijuana, and we're not going to have one legalizing it. This Congress is a hell of a long way from legalizing pot, but the changes have been coming, hopefully fewer people may will get down to the point where no one goes to prison for pot and everybody gets out. I mean, it is ridiculous that it's been illegal, and I just want to reemphasize that the whole marijuana, the whole drug war is purely political. Never had anything to do with public health, quite the opposite. And if we're looking at one of the reasons that the electorate in this country has been decimated, it's because of felony convictions and other extractions of human beings from society, from their families, from their communities. I do want to conclude, and maybe real quickly, it seems the one big surprise out of Colorado is the popularity of edibles. We're going to have to deal with that another time. Thank you both, Eric and David. You're a great guest. Thanks to the crew in New York. We'll
David, nice to meet you. Harvey, thank you so much.
Yes,
thank
Harvey,
you guys.
Thank you.
And
it was a pleasure talking to you.
Another great Solartopia Hour. Take care, everybody.